From the Farm Progress Show in Decatur, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 27th day of August 2019. Happy anniversary to my lovely bride of 31 years, Clarann Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets. Dale Durkles is here. We'll also take a look at what the release from USDA this morning might mean for acreage. Probably only cover crop acreage, but we'll do that with Scott Irwin from the University of Illinois. And we'll hear about the reason Klaus thinks it can now compete in the USA and North America, and how they are tweaking their line of tractors and combines to do just that. Let's turn our attention to what's happened in Chicago. These are closes and not settlements at the CME Group in Chicago. September corn up about a penny and a half today, 357. December 356, 2 1/4 lower. Soybeans were down 7 1/4 at 846 and a half. In the January at 873 and a quarter, they were down 7 1/4. In that November contract, down 8 cents at 859 and a quarter. Bean oil down 31 cents. The bean meal $1.30 lower. And wheat futures were about unchanged in the lead option September. Dale Durkles is now here. He is with Grain Cycles. You can find him online and Twitter. Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate you taking time with me today.
Hey, it's always good to be here and talk with you, especially with the crowds we have wandering around today.
Yeah, so the Farm Progress Show is really pretty busy today. There was supposed to be a lot of rain, so that maybe kept a few folks around off. But this site's gotten awfully busy. And I bet you've had some interesting conversations as producers have recognized you walking around the showgrounds.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people that I haven't seen since I retired back in the middle of June from AgriVisor and GrowMark. So it has been rewarding to see and talk with some of them and their ever-present question, what's this market going to do?
And do you have an ever-present answer?
Oh, I've always got an answer. It depends whether it's right or wrong. That's always the key.
And what is it today?
I think we'll see better markets again once we move off on into the fall, and you know how deep we move into the fall and how high prices might move is going to be contingent upon the weather we have here in the fall and at what point we have that frost freeze and we terminate the crops themselves, because that'll have implications on yield.
So is this all about yield for you at this point?
I think at this juncture, you really have to be all about yield. You know, the corn numbers in August on acreage, you know, it's pretty well a settled issue. We'll tweak harvested acreage maybe a little bit. Beans, I noticed, you know, acreage could come down 300,000, maybe a half million. But acreage numbers are reasonably well settled. Now we've really got to focus concern and expectations on what kind of yield numbers are we going to see. And I think this is going to be like 2010, for example. We'll know once the combine rolls.
Can you recognize in the pattern of trade a seasonal pattern at this point?
Well, seasonally, you know, you step back and you understand, you know, and it's not unusual to put in lows at the beginning of harvest for corn or beans, either one. You know, there are some other timing indicators there when you start looking at some long-term or cyclic studies in particular that are away from seasonals, that they suggest a bean low can come in here somewhere right around Labor Day. Corn a little bit more fluid a little later, maybe early to middle September.
So those numbers would be a pre-harvest low. That is a seasonal we have worked with. Oftentimes we think about it as when we get to 50% harvested, we find our lows.
Well, I think this time around we're going to come in early because of the attitude, the ideas that, you know, the yield numbers USDA used out of the shoot there in August, which really, those were based on a farmer survey, so you can't say they were unfair. But I think everybody, in looking at the crop since Pro Farmers Tour last week, some other independent things that I've read in here, and even some independent work and looking at past USDA history tells me we'll come down. And like I say, the real question is how much, and that's what we don't know.
Where do you think prices can go?
If we use 1993 as an example, actually the corn market peaked out January 94 with the USDA crop report and actually ended up making a new high. The bean market itself, I think it went to a new high. It wasn't quite as strong, but they were up into that same period, might have actually gone a little deeper into February.
93 was a problem with getting a handle on, I think, acreage, but I don't know how long it took them to get a handle on yield.
yield all the way through to the end. You know, when you look at the yield on corn, which I remember, well, beans were a little flatter on yield through the progression of reports. But from the August report, USDA projected 116 bushel. We consistently went lower all the way into that January that had a yield number that was just under 101.
Any final advice for producers, especially those who still have old crop corn, that they need to move or to continue holding?
You know, I think basically the best way to handle old crop corn is via either sell the cash, buy something back on the board, or an easier way for a lot of people out there is put stuff on a basis contract. Get out from under those initial storage charges you're going to get at your own local commercial elevator. So if you put it under a basis contract, leaves the futures side open, ties up the basis. And this year with some of the positive basis, especially in the central and eastern part of the Corn Belt, it's not such a bad idea either.
Hey, thanks so much, Dale.
Always good talking with you.
Dale Durkles is with Grain Cycles. He's retired from AgriVisor. We appreciate him dropping by here at the Farm Progress Show. You can find us in the tent on West Avenue and 3rd Street. And we're here each and every day. It is, as you said, the University of Illinois tent.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, here on the Farm Progress Show site in Decatur, Illinois, there are often product releases. Klaus invited me in early this morning to see a few things, and I thought it was fairly interesting that this company, a German company, was talking about North America and farmers specifically in North America and tweaking their product line for them. Drew Fletcher is here now to talk a little bit about the tractors. Thank you, Drew, for being with us. So you showed us tractors and some new innovative things that are happening in them. But the one question I really wanted to know is, what's the difference between what you do in Europe and what you're doing here in the United States?
Well, the way we farm and the way we use tractors here in North America is much different. We tend to farm a little slower, but wider. And in Europe, they tend to do double pass a little faster, a little narrower. Some of it's driven by their field size. Some of it's driven by the roadside. But the other thing is, our duty cycle is much different. So we had to spend a lot of time testing specifically in North America, checking to make sure we didn't overheat. So like in our 880 tractor, the European version, when we got to testing here in North America, we would go into heat stress. Would derate and it would start to overheat. So we ended up actually having to change the fan out, add extra fan blade, extra pitch, and make it go a little bit faster so we could keep it cooler in our higher ambient temperatures than they typically see. Hydraulics is another place that we use a lot more hydraulics than they do. They use a lot more PTO driven or a lot more electrical drives. We're just starting to get to that here in North America, but our hydraulic drives, so with the Axion, particularly in the 800 series, we are releasing a double pump. So the standard, the high flow version from Europe is only 40 gallons per minute and a single pump, so a single priority. So what we've done is added a second pump to get us up to 54 gallons a minute of total flow, but it's that second pump for that twin priority system so that we can drive air fans as well as seed meters. And not have to have the crosstalk in the pressure spikes. So a lot of those things, you know, wheels, tires, beyond the normal safety and standards, but all of those kind of things to make it fit better for our North American applications.
So row width and tires are entirely different?
Yes. We rely very heavily on duals because we don't have a width restriction of 2.55 meters on our roadways and things. So in Europe, they tend to use single large volume tires, where we tend to use typically a 480 section width with duals. Of course, that changes the whole drive dynamics of the axle fitment equipment, the hubs, the offsets of the rims, and those kind of things, so that we can fit the North American market better.
Interestingly, I think I heard this too, you have tractors with tires that are developed specifically for forages.
Yes, I mean, Kloss, we focus on everything that happens above the ground. So we're very strong with forage harvesters. We're very strong with combines, very strong with mowers and balers and hay tools. So that's kind of where a lot of our design concept focuses on the tractors, is to be able to run triple mowers and be able to run quadrant balers and those kind of things. But as we get into North America, you know, corn and beans is our life here, especially in the center section of the U.S. in the Corn Belt. And not as much hay and not as much forage happens in Illinois as it does, say, in Idaho. And so that design concept changes much differently. Again, the duty cycles that we see, the heat loads that we see, you know, those kind of things really changes it.
And the row crop just requires a different set of tracks or wheels on the ground.
It goes further than that. It's the row crop market. When we say row crop to a lot of the Europeans, they just think a 480 section with tire. But it goes deeper than that. It's the hydraulics. It's the cab size. It's the visibility to certain parts for your planters and some of your tillage. It's turn radius. It's a lot of those things all wrapped together. And so it's not just a 480 section with tire.
One of the biggest concerns of most producers and the reasons that they use the equipment that they do sometimes is because they just like that equipment, but more often than not, it's because they have a dealership that they can depend upon.
Yes. Dealers are the lifeblood of the manufacturer, for sure. And so we've spent a lot of time trying to optimize our dealer footprint and our dealer network. Throughout the history of Kloss in North America, we've had kind of a segmented dealer network. We're trying to get that all together in our long line concept. And so we have done a lot of work in recent years. We still have more work to do to make sure that the customers, the farmers, have the parts, the service, the availability, the people tied to the community, the people that understand what they go through day in, day out, the people that they know and trust, to make sure that is accessible to them.
That's Drew Fletcher of Kloss, joined us here on the Closing Market Report for this Tuesday afternoon. Remember to look us up and listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at willag.org, willag.org, and to come and visit us at the Farm Progress Show. We have a stage show at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 1 o'clock, and 2 o'clock in the University of Illinois tent. We're right inside the main gate. If you turn to the right, that's on West Avenue and about 3rd Street. Look for us in the University of Illinois tent. And, of course, at 10 o'clock in the morning, Orion Samuelson takes the stage. And at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm up on the stage. Well, we're here at the Farm Progress Show, of course. It's beautiful. Come out and visit us. We have stage shows at 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, and 2 o'clock each and every day. At 10 a.m. in the morning, Orion is here with a whole bunch of guests. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm up on stage with a whole bunch of guests. And one of those people that shows up with both of us is Scott Irwin. He's an agricultural economist and is out on the site today on this Tuesday afternoon. He was very early on checking out what USDA had to say about cover crops and FSA acreage this morning. They had a release. Can you tell me about that?
Right. They provided Todd an update to the certified FSA acreage data that was first released simultaneously with the August crop production report. That data set was as of August 1st. They normally do a once-a-month release of that FSA certified acreage data, but they did an intermediate release this morning. And that data showed that total corn and soybean acreage in that certified FSA database was up about 800,000, and then you had a few hundred thousand acre increase in the prevent plant acreage. But, you know, that was all pretty standard issue stuff that wasn't real noteworthy. We would expect all those numbers to float upwards over time as we get more complete reporting. But there was one number that was quite noteworthy.
And what was that?
Well, at the end of the report, which I really recommend to people, it's a really well-written report that came out today and helps explain the differences between the FSA and NAS reporting system on acreage. But this odd fact at the end of the report was reported that the total number of acres in the FSA database that were classified as cover crops in those 3 weeks between those reporting dates, August 1st and August 22nd, increased from 2.7 to 4.7 million acres. Just suddenly, they found 2 million acres of cover crops.
So farmers, on hearing that, are going to say, hey, that's a good deal because that 90 million just dropped.
And that's not necessarily true, so long, because NASS is supposed to count prevent plant that's planted to a cover crop. For example, let's say a farmer had prevent plant on corn and planted soybeans as his cover crop. NASS is supposed to count that soybean cover crop acre as a planted acre of soybeans. That's what they say, and they've always been consistent about that. So I don't think that that reporting has really any major implications for what the true planted acreage of corn and soybeans is.
So the expectation from your point of view, and I don't know whether this is quite true, would be that the 90 million would stay where it is and not move much in either direction?
You know, I probably would lean towards that it might drift down a bit, because we're just in a very unusual reporting and sampling environment. So I wouldn't be surprised if it trickled down a little bit. But the real uncertainty is what that classification of cover crop acres means for harvested acreage. For example, I mean, I'm hearing a lot of Illinois farmers who had prevent plant acres on corn, the cheapest alternative was to plant them to bin run soybeans. And that was fine. And NASS should have caught that as planted acres of soybeans. But those are not supposed to be harvested for grain in order to meet the provisions of being a cover crop.
Yeah. So clarification, NASS would have caught it as planted acres to soybeans, but as a cover crop.
No, NASS does not keep that classification. FSA does. NASS only counts what's planted, not its purpose for which it is planted. In other words, NASS assumes in their accounting everything that's a planted acre within normal bounds is harvested.
You're telling me that planted acreage for soybeans could go up?
No, don't think so. If NASS included those cover crop acres properly, in their sampling, in their resurvey that they did in July and announced in August, everything's fine. The real issue is, if they've properly captured the soybean cover crop acres that were originally intended to be corn, their corn PP, that's fine. But then those acres are not supposed to be harvested for soybean grain. And that would mean that you would have a larger than normal difference between planted and harvested soybean acres. So, you know, let's say that there's a million acres of prevent plant on corn that was converted to a cover crop with soybeans. NASS properly account for that. Then you should take another million acres off of harvested soybean acres, because that stuff's never going to be harvested. In a normal year, you would expect everything but, you know, 500,000-600,000 acres of soybeans to be harvested. But there's a lot more uncertainty, and that sudden jump of 2 million acres, you know, really should raise eyebrows about, or, you know, it's noteworthy in that there's just much more uncertainty this year about the size of harvested soybean acres relative to planted. And some additional uncertainty on corn, because you could also take your cover crops and plant it to silage. You could actually take corn prevent plant acres, replant it to corn, and harvest it for silage after September 1st. And to NASS, that's all corn, you know, that's just planted acres for corn. So we still have some story left to tell in terms of harvested acreage of corn and soybeans.
Will the World Agricultural Outlook Board take these numbers, because they were official numbers from the chief economist at USDA, and try to incorporate them into the September World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate Report, often known as the WASDE figures?
I doubt it. I'd be surprised about that, because they don't really have any data that would help them disentangle this answer until we get all the way to the December 1st agricultural survey that will release the final sets of planted and harvested acreage in January. I really don't think we're going to know the final answer to this uncertainty until we get all the way to January this year.
In this report this morning, there was one point of clarification as it relates to cover crops, because 18 commodities, corn, soybeans, wheat, among them, can be used as cover crops. And there was a difference potentially in the payment, at least in the minds of producers, maybe even from some of the USDA office's point of view.
Right. So in this chain of logic, let's say you had corn, you took prevent plant payment on corn acres, and then you planted those to soybeans as a cover crop before August 1st, and now you can just plow them under, mow them under, or you can try to bale them, chop them, or graze. I don't think you can graze those soybeans after September 1st. So that's what you can do with the physical acres. Where this really gets tricky is, what are the correct FSA rules as far as taking MFP2 payments on the cover crop acres? The USDA had a footnote in their report this morning that indicated that if you had corn prevent plant and then you planted a cover crop to it, you were only eligible for a $15 per acre payment on the cover crops. You know, I'm just saying, I know that there's some variation out there in how that rule is being applied, and that some people have taken this FSA allowance of double counting. You know, you can have a prevent plant for corn, and then you can count it for a cover crop or something else, and they're getting the full MFP2 payment. And, you know, so this is just a case where some clarity and transparency will help everyone. Because if, you know, some people are getting the full MFP2 payment on their cover crop acres, then all farmers ought to know about that. So what are the rules?
Well, I guess clarity is yet to come.
Well, I'm guessing that you'll see that coming after the USDA absorbs maybe feedback from this. So hopefully they're listening, Todd.
Scott Irwin is an agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. We talked to him at the Farm Progress Show in Decatur.